So this morning's sermon is a little heavy, so I want to get the laughter part up front, which is good. That's a good start, but I'm going to dedicate a little dance to Brother Michael in the choir.
I just love that, you know, I can talk to Michael and say, well, I was thinking about these two songs. Oh, why don't I put them together and, like, we'll do a little number. It was so great, so great. And it was beautiful this morning, so thank you for that. I was at a conference for climate change on Friday, and one of the rabbis who was there taught us this little piece that I wanted to share with you. It's called The Sabbath Dance. See if you can pick it up. One, two, three, four, five, six, rest. One, two, three, four, five, six, rest. Get it? For Brother Michael in the choir.
Okay, the laughter's over. Sorry. Veterans Day is this coming Tuesday. We may all be aware, hopefully, celebrating the service of all U.S. military veterans and observed annually on the 11th day of the 11th month, recognizing the day and actually originally the time, 11 a.m., when the official armistice with Germany ending World War I in 1918 went into effect. The observance began as Armistice Day a year later in 1919, Woodrow Wilson proclaimed, "To us in America, the reflections of Armistice Day will be filled with solemn pride in the heroism of those who died in the country's service, and with gratitude for the victory, both because of the thing from which it has freed us and because of the opportunity it has given America to show her sympathy with peace and justice in the councils of the nations." Number of years later, after World War II, President Eisenhower signed the change from Armistice Day to Veterans Day in 1954, thereafter including all those who have served to be acknowledged, not just those in memory. So here we are 60 years after that 1954 decision or proclamation, with far less popular, if one can use that term, conflicts between the 50s and now, still setting aside the time to acknowledge and appreciate military service to our country. No doubt there have been many years when this holiday passed by hardly noticed or noticed with discomfort, to say the least. In the 60s and 70s, many people had little interest in appreciating, let alone celebrating, military service, a fact that many service people experienced as isolating at best, dismissive and hurtful. The post-9/11 era has found us generally more appreciative of those who serve, even if at odds with the conflicts they are serving in. Whatever perspective we find ourselves in about war or with about war and service to country, suffice it to say, it's a complicated relationship. We yearn for peace. And yet, and if it weren't difficult enough, should we or shouldn't we have wars, participate in them, and what is a sufficient reason? We add God to the mix. We know that belief, whatever our particular belief is always a part of what motivates humanity. We don't do things for no apparent reason, and something like war requires pretty significant motivation. Our psalm this morning, Psalm 137, suggests one option. They were angry. They wanted retribution. When we get back to Jerusalem, we will dash your children on the rocks. You destroyed our temple and exiled us from our homeland, and when we get back, you'll pay. You destroyed our buildings. You stole our sense of security. We can't let you get away with that. Does that sound vaguely familiar? Oh, and by the way, God is on our side. We are the righteous. Does that sound familiar? I think God might be out there somewhere thinking, wait just a minute, don't get me involved in all this. This is your doing, after all. Lincoln suggested another motivation for war in his second inaugural address. Both parties deprecated war, he said, but one of them would make war rather than let the nation survive, and the other would accept war rather than let it perish, and the war came. And both sides, he reminded us, claimed God. So, ironically, I'm not actually here to talk about war today. No one in their right mind, and I do not use that term right mind lightly, wants war or seeks war. The operative phrase here is in their right mind. Acts of aggression are motivated by emotions like revenge or righteousness or pride or power or greed. I would suggest that those are not right mind motivations, certainly not kind or generous of spirit or community oriented, at least not beyond one's specific community. I'm reminded of a comment that I read this week in Stan Gross's article. He wrote an essay about his service and visiting the Vietnam War Memorial in Washington, D.C. I cried about the insanity of war that makes timing and luck the arbiter of who lives and who dies. I'm not a student of war, nor am I naive enough to imagine that war will cease anytime soon, or that we do not need an armed services at present to provide for our security, though I would hope we can work towards a time when that may not be so. What I'm more interested in today is what we as human beings have ironically done to the idea of God in our efforts to be motivated in warfare. What humanity has done throughout its history, and what our own small piece of it right here in the United States might be. I'm interested in how we have constrained and constricted our understanding of God in order to feel protected. Is it possible we have debilitated our capacity to find wholeness, to reach out to a life-giving source and spirit because we have attenuated conflict to its meaning, limiting the breadth of its possibility in our human need for self-justification? How might we have robbed ourselves of a healing source by linking constructs of the holy to our individual and self-serving human needs? Did you know that the motto, "In God We Trust," did not appear on American currency until 1865, the year the Civil War ended? Then director of the U.S. Mint, James Pollock, stated, "'Tis an hour of national peril and danger, an hour when man's strength is weakness, when our strength and our nation's strength and salvation must be in the God of battles and of nations." Congress passed legislation in April of 1864, giving Pollock the responsibility for the shape, mottos, and devices placed on the 1- and 2-cent coins, subject to the approval of the Secretary of Treasury, and so they began to include "In God We Trust" on those two coins. In 1908, legislation was passed mandating that the motto shall hereafter be inscribed upon all such gold and silver coins of said denominations as heretofore. And though challenged, the courts have consistently found its placement constitutional. In fact, its imprint has been expanded to paper money and all coinage in 1955. In an era that can also historically be considered a time of acute challenge, it was the Cold War era. The concern was to establish a religious United States in opposition to a cold and godless Soviet Republic. Additionally, "In God We Trust" was designated a national motto in 1956. With Congress asserting it will be of great spiritual and psychological value to our country to have a clearly designated national motto of inspirational quality in plain, popularly accepted English. As though God were ours. I hope those of you who are less inclined to engage with this particular vocabulary, with God vocabulary, will understand my intention today. Sometimes, even in our rationally oriented Unitarian Universalist congregations, we need to talk about theology. And by that, I mean not the strict construction of the study of the nature of God per se, but the broader question of how we understand our place in the universe as a whole, relative to the idea that there is something greater than we are, something other, something mysterious, some energy perhaps with which we might engage for sustenance and support, for understanding beyond our meager abilities. Walter Brueggemann is a renowned theologian and scholar of the Hebrew Scriptures, a prolific author, who wrote Hopeful Imagination, Prophetic Voices in Exile. We have been visiting exile texts today, from the psalm and the song that Michael and I offered earlier to the departure song we sang for our children this morning, which is from Isaiah, referencing going out in joy and returning in peace. I use these texts not for their biblical weight this morning, but because I think they remind us that we are, most of us in the 21st century, living to a large degree in exile as well. In exile from a relationship with something or anything we might call holy. We have so constrained the definition of what there might be that some of us hardly recognize the possibility anymore. In the text of Hopeful Imagination, Brueggemann describes the Israelite community in exile as engaging in a misunderstanding of self, imagining that it is more valued by God than it is. Additionally, Israel engages while in exile in a misunderstanding of God, imagining that God is more enmeshed with and beholden than in fact God is. Israel, in fact, engages in narcissism, Brueggemann says, imagining that God exists for the sake of Israel. But don't we all do that? Don't we all engage in the narcissism of imagining that God exists for us, even when we entertain the idea at all? Aren't we all guilty of imagining that all of this, this world, this amazing planet, these beautiful colors we've seen today, don't we imagine sometimes that it exists for our benefit? I think we forget that we are the visitors. Certainly our culture inclines us to this narcissism, the same assumption that God is here for us. Does it drive any of you crazy that American presidents now end their speeches with God bless America? As though God is so invested in the success or security of the United States. Our country is only 250 years old, for goodness sakes. Give it some time. The world has been around for how many millions of years? And we have the audacity to imagine that God is busy blessing us. We have had opportunities, I think, to do what sociologist Robert Bella called a reformation of God symbolism. Most recently, in the post-9/11 era, when confronted with the anger and hostility of a population using symbols of American power, the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, as targets for their wrath, we might have set God in a holistic frame by encouraging a consideration of what is universal in human needs. Author Jim Wallace suggested we might have acknowledged that defeating terrorism is both practically and spiritually connected to the deeper work of addressing global poverty and resolving the conflicts that sow the bitter seeds of despair and violence. And instead, we played to people's worst fears. The Christian Century wrote, "What is alarming is that then President Bush seems to have had no reservations about the notion that God and the good are squarely on the American side. The thing is, that wasn't new. And it wasn't only George Bush, though he did participate in a rather significant missed opportunity. God Bless America went viral. And still, we are in exile from a construct that might hold us all in reverence before creation, if we could get ourselves out of the way. I revisited a powerful piece of literature in preparing for today. I don't know if it's familiar to any of you. It's called The Trial of God by Elie Wiesel. Is that familiar to anyone? I recommend it to you. It's a powerful, powerful piece. At age 15, interned in Auschwitz, Wiesel witnessed three Jewish scholars put God on trial for his crimes against creation and humankind. Witnesses were heard, evidence was gathered, conclusions were drawn, a unanimous verdict. The Lord God Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, was found guilty. And then, after what Wiesel described as an infinity of silence, the Talmudic scholar looked at the sky and said, "It's time for evening prayers." And the members of the tribunal recited Ma'ariv, the evening service. Having had this experience as a young person, Wiesel later writes The Trial of God, but sets it in a 17th century Polish town, recently devastated by a pogrom. In the afterword to the play, Matthew Fox writes, "This play may be less about putting God on trial than about putting our uses and abuses and projections of God on trial. Beware of theologians and excessive rationalizations," he says. Wiesel is warning us, and rightly so, for theology too easily strays into the lap of the left brain, too far from the guts where injustices as well as compassion are felt and where wonder and amazement are tasted. Like Mary walking in the woods this morning, I thought, this is where wonder and amazement are tasted, and I am a visitor to this holy place. In Wiesel's play, the innkeeper, who is Jewish and whose wife and two or three children have just been killed, is angry, understandably. But at who? "Yes, I'm boiling with anger," he says. "I want to understand why he is giving strength to the killers and nothing but tears and the shame of helplessness to the victims." His friend says, "So you don't understand? Neither do I. Is that enough reason to reject him? Suppose you understood, would you accept?" "No, I wouldn't. But why not?" "Because I would refuse to understand. I would refuse to understand so as not to forgive him." All our names for God come from our understanding of ourselves, warns 13th century mystic Meister Eckhart. We are self-referential because it's the construct we best understand. But holy imagination, hopeful imagination, as Brueggemann encourages, would have us understand ourselves as participants in a much larger arena, one that might incline us to be better guests. Like Noah and Nama this morning, it's our job to do better. In a holistic construct of what is holy, no sides are chosen, no favorites come out on top. We are all in this beautiful, demanding, and complicated existence together that was here long before we were. And we are not the center, and there is no entity pointing, directing, or willfully attending to our individual existences. Let's not be so full of ourselves as to imagine it so. God, if it exists, is bigger than that. There are no holy wars, but that doesn't mean there is no holy. Something to think about, perhaps. I return you to your dance. 1, 2, 3. three, four, five, six, rest. Amen.